Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case for argument is Columbus Regional Hospital against the Federal Emergency Management Agency. Mr. Huber.
May it please the court, before I get into the details, I'd like to highlight three main points that I'll focus on today. Point number one, FEMA is not permitted to discriminate based on its perception that the hospital...
Actually, Mr. Huber, before you get into any points, I have an antecedent question. Why is there federal subject matter jurisdiction in this case?
The Stafford Act would give that jurisdiction, I believe.
Pardon?
I believe the Stafford Act, under which the case was brought.
That may be an authority to grant relief, but you need a source of federal jurisdiction. Now, normally, the source of federal jurisdiction in suits against the United States seeking money is the Tucker Act. It's 28 U.S.C. 1346. The Tucker Act provides that if you want more than $10,000, the suit has to be brought in the Court of Federal Claims. And it's my understanding you want more than $10,000.
We do, Your Honor. We're asking for the same type of relief that the Ninth Circuit granted in the State of Hawaii case. And I don't really know of any difference with respect to subject matter jurisdiction between that case and this case.
So what is the basis of subject matter jurisdiction? And you can't say the Stafford Act. It's a pretty fundamental principle that you need a grant of jurisdiction in addition to a statute authorizing relief.
Your Honor, that issue wasn't raised below. I would need
subject matter jurisdiction is a question at every stage, which the court is obliged to raise on its own, and which, of course, the lawyers are obliged to discuss in their briefs.
Yes, I agree with that, Your Honor.
Do you have an answer to my question?
I would like to get back to you on my rebuttal time on that point, if I may, Your Honor. FEMA should not be permitted to discriminate based on its perception that the hospital was too well-heeled and did not need financial assistance. That happened here. It happened with respect to the insurance decision and the equipment decision. Point number two, FEMA's insurance decision violated the Stafford Act, the legislative history, the case law, and the clarification FEMA adopted. The duplicative benefits rule is a legislative rule. Here it was promulgated without notice and comment. Also, we're talking about Section 5155 of the Act, and one must read subparts B3 and C together. Here, both FEMA and the district court below focused almost entirely on subpart C and ignored subpart B3. As in the case law and the clarification which FEMA adopted, a commercially reasonable standard should apply here.
I was surprised, actually, that FEMA was willing to give you as much as they did. It seemed to me, if the question was what funds are available, they could have taken the position that everything under an insurance policy that covers both eligible and ineligible losses is available. Instead, they apportion, which gives you a good chunk of the policy.
Well, here in this case, Your Honor, the hospital collected policy limits. There was no question about the hospital not pursuing a policy.
I know, and I'm saying FEMA could have. They didn't. They adopted a rule, whether we call it, whatever kind of rule we call it, that said that they apportion when there's a policy like this one that doesn't specify how to allocate as among eligible and ineligible losses. They didn't say, and I have no trouble understanding why, that it was up to the private entity seeking money from the government to decide how much money from the government it was entitled to get. They said we'll apportion, but it seems like they could have said it all goes to eligible, and if something's left over, you can spend it on ineligible. And this is just a cash flow issue anyway. Had you spent all of this money and been willing to reimburse, there's no issue.
Your Honor, I would submit FEMA could have done that, but it would have violated subpart B3 of the statute, because that statute makes it clear that if after receiving partial benefits, which is really the issue here, not duplicative benefits, if there's any remaining loss that has not yet been reimbursed, that loss should be reimbursed.
Partial benefits that are of eligible expenses. You're mixing apples and oranges. You're mixing up the money available to pay eligible expenses with the question what proportion of eligible expenses have been covered.
Well, Your Honor, here the hospital sustained a $160 million loss,
yeah,
95
I mean,
million.
People lose in these things. Ask anybody who's lived through tornadoes or floods or hurricanes. There are significant losses. The federal government, as you may have noticed reading the newspapers, is not flush with money, and so they're trying to allocate as well as they can the funds for these emergencies.
There's nothing in the statute, Your Honor, about allocation. There's a very clear mandate in the statute in subpart B3 and C. Subpart 1 says you can't delay giving financial assistance. Here there was a huge delay in giving financial assistance. Subpart B3 applies to the effect of partial benefits, which I would submit applies here. Subpart C applies to the recovery of duplicative benefits.
Where in the statute does it say that all losses are eligible for reimbursement?
That's the general mandate of Congress to
even
make sure.
Even business interruption? All losses
no,
in your
no,
position
not,
are available for?
I would agree that business interruption losses are not FEMA eligible.
Right, so there's already a cut. Some losses are eligible, others are not. Where in the statute does it say that there's a 100% reimbursement rate by FEMA?
I'm not contending that there's a 100%
there
reimbursement
isn't. That's
rate.
That's why you can't, because it's a 75% rate. And where in the statute do you see that FEMA has no authority to interpret the term in the statute, what funds are available?
Well, if the statute is unambiguous, and I would submit here when read in its entirety is not ambiguous, FEMA does not have the discretion to interpret the statute in a way that frustrates congressional intent.
What do you think available means?
Available would apply in a situation where the hospital had an additional policy that it had not yet pursued, or as in the State of Hawaii case before the Ninth Circuit, where the policy limits would be $50 million, for instance, and the hospital would collect $25 or $30 in settlement, then that would come into play, where there's a question about an additional amounts being available. Here, the hospital acted in a commercially reasonable way.
That doesn't mean it's available or not, and it doesn't have anything to do with when they spent what dollars. It has to do with which dollars the federal government is obliged under the Stafford Act to reimburse, if any.
Well, here, Your Honor, there will be $16 million that are FEMA-eligible costs that will remain unreimbursed, that are eligible for reimbursement, that would have been reimbursed in every other scenario.
Well, the reason, because of the duplicative benefits rule. You can't, look, who would spend a nickel on eligible expenses if you knew you could spend your whole $25 million on business interruption and then just go and get $25 million from FEMA for property loss? Nobody. I mean, people are not silly.
But here, Your Honor.
No, you agree with that, right? No
yes,
one.
I agree.
It would be, so you're saying that somewhere in the statute, and I just don't see this language, is a rule that says that potential recipients get to drain their resources for ineligible expenses so that they can maximize their recovery from FEMA.
I would agree there's nothing in the statute about hypothetical insurance allocations, and that's why this duplicative benefits rule is a legislative rule.
There's nothing in the statute that says that it's up to the recipient to decide what's eligible. Not a word.
Well, in this case, the hospital had three sets of bills that it received. The first set of bills related to business interruption losses, namely payroll, and we all agree that that is not a FEMA-eligible expense. The second two categories of expenses, which were received in that order, were loss for emergency restoration services and rebuilding and contracting services for rebuilding the building. Those are the expenses that the hospital paid with its $25 million in proceeds, and it's not asking for reimbursement for those amounts, but it is asking reimbursement for all other FEMA-eligible expenses that FEMA is refusing to reimburse.
I understand that's your position. I regard it as kind of ships passing in the night. That's not the way FEMA is analyzing this statute. And it's hard for me to see what's so unambiguous about this word available, since you've offered three or four different definitions while you've been standing there.
If one were to read the term available in isolation and ignore subpart B3, I would agree there's more than one reasonable interpretation, but we can't ignore what subpart B3 says, which is squarely on point.
I don't think B3 helps you at all. B3 is just about partial recovery once the appropriate funds have been applied. It's a timing thing.
Here, Your Honor, we know that the Herman Memorial Hospital allocated its insurance payment in exactly the same way as...
And what's happening to them now?
Well, we know from the materials in the audit that they did allocate their insurance in the same way the hospital is asking to allocate here. The only difference between that case and this case that we know about is the evidence of discrimination based upon economic status.
Well, but Herman... there's a 2010 FEMA audit that found that Herman's proceeds were improperly apportioned. I think that's still an open case, at least the last public documents indicate.
If Herman Memorial Hospital was asked to reimburse that money, I would expect FEMA to be in here telling the court that that's exactly what happened, and they have not done that.
Maybe open. They wouldn't be telling us something's happened if it hasn't happened yet.
Based on the evidence in the record, it appears that that hospital was allowed to do exactly what
So once a mistake has been made, the government, in your view, is stopped forever from fixing it?
I don't know what happened, Your Honor. I would simply look to FEMA and...
But let's assume it was a mistake. Is it your view that once the government... Essentially, I'm asking you, what's your view of estoppel against the government if people who work for the government make a mistake?
I would agree there's a statute that says you cannot assert estoppel.
Right.
We're not arguing for estoppel.
Well, but you sort of are, actually, you're saying that Herman created a precedent from which it can't recover.
Based on the record, I can't answer your question as to what happened. I would expect FEMA to come forward and explain if they were asked to reimburse that money down in Texas.
And I'm saying maybe it doesn't make any difference, because if there's no estoppel against the government, the worst you can say is they let Herman get away with something that they now believe was inappropriate under the law. And if there's no estoppel, they're entitled to present whatever they do think is appropriate under the law.
I would submit, Your Honor, at a minimum, there's a question of fact about whether the consideration, which was completely improper under the statute, of the hospital's financial status played any role in this. We simply asked for discovery about that. We weren't allowed any discovery. We raised that issue to the district court, and the court didn't address it.
We looked through the record to see who said that that the hospital was too wealthy, and we didn't actually see that phrase anyplace. I have affidavits from people who recount conversations that allegedly Mr. Schultz said CRH didn't really need FEMA because of its cash reserves, and I have another affidavit that has a comparable statement. CRH didn't need assistance. But then, of course, CRH got a lot of money from FEMA, so I'm not sure what weight to... Wasn't it $60 million or something?
It will be $70 million when the process is completed.
All right, $70 million, excuse me. So whatever these offhand remarks were certainly didn't seem to prevent the hospital from getting what seems to be a lot of money.
According to the affidavits in there, too, Marlene Weatherwax and Sherry
right
Wilson...
In front of me.
To Danny Rood and Eric Schultz, who were the low-level decision-makers, they basically admitted to the hospital that that was a factor. And they asked lots of questions about economic status. And we cited to the court to those requests for that information, which should be irrelevant.
But you filled out reams of forms, as everybody does. Of course, the government wants to know what assets are available. So... You know, if somebody makes an offhand remark, I don't know why it has such legal significance.
Well, I would submit that, Your Honor, the district court is required to construe that evidence in favor of the hospital in this case, and the court didn't even consider it.
But other than your legal arguments about the way equipment is valued and the way insurance proceeds are allocated, I don't understand what those remarks have to do with anything, actually.
Well, under the statute.
What request that you made, other than the two you've raised on this appeal, do you think was denied because of some unpleasant remark about the hospital's financial resources?
There were two. One on the equipment issue.
So, right. It's just the two issues that you have here, and they're legal arguments
that
you're presenting about that.
Yes.
And you were partially reimbursed for the equipment at the then value of the equipment, and you did get part of the insurance policy. So it's really legal issues. It does, I just don't see the pertinence of these remarks.
Well, Your Honor, it's an issue that we presented to the court. If the court is inclined to disregard that, I'll move on to the second point. Again, in looking at the statute, there are three parts, B1, B3, and subpart C, that we would submit should be read together. We don't see that this is a case where availability is an issue at all. It's an issue of receiving partial benefits and not receiving the full amount of eligible reimbursements for the bills that have not yet been reimbursed. And looking at the legislative history, it seems like the legislative history under these provisions, the basic point is thou shalt not be reimbursed for the same bill twice. And that's not an issue here. The hospital is not asking to be reimbursed for any bill that it's already been reimbursed for. And the hospital did not do anything untoward regarding the bills. It paid the first three bills that it received, and it paid them in the order that it received those bills. One was for payroll, and two sets of bills were for FEMA-eligible expenses, and hospital's not asking for reimbursement of those bills again. The basic point of the statute and the legislative history, we would submit that applicants should not collect twice for the same bill, and partial benefits don't eliminate reimbursement for other eligible losses that remain. The Ninth Circuit's decision in the state of Hawaii case is very helpful, makes it clear that the applicant in the hospital's position should act in a commercially reasonable way. It shouldn't ignore its own bills. It should get equal consideration to recovering federal money as it recovers its own money. And that's exactly what the hospital did. It acted in a commercially reasonable way, paid the bills in the order in which they were received. And it seems that FEMA agrees with that interpretation because the clarification that FEMA joined in, which interprets this same statute, has a definition of duplicative benefits that I would submit should apply here.
But even in the Hawaii case, it is distinguishable from this circumstance because the insurance company there contested the amount.
It did because there was a settlement for less than policy limits. Here, we would submit there's no issue of availability under subpart C because the hospital obtained the maximum amount of recovery allowed, $25 million, the policy limit.
Again, that's just how many... That's how many dollars are out there, and then the next question is how many of those dollars are available for the purposes that are described in the statute. In other words, you know, property versus business interruption, to put it in these terms. And so knowing the total amount, you know, you were, of course, commercially reasonable, if you will, when you received the full $25 million, but it doesn't tell you whether every one of those dollars is available for ineligible expenses.
And here, the hospital was very upfront with FEMA and said, here are our bills. It was very upfront with the insurance company and said, here's why we need the reimbursement. FEMA never objected, and the monies were paid.
Why would FEMA care, given the reimbursement provisions in the regulations? They're trying to the hospital was not the only entity that FEMA was working with after this big flood. It may certainly have been the biggest of them. But why would FEMA make a big fuss about the order in which the hospital paid things, knowing that the regulatory scheme allows after-the-fact adjustments?
Certainly they could make after-the-fact adjustments.
Right. So here. Why are they going to waste their effort fussing with you about which bills you've paid when they know that in time it can all be sorted out?
Well, they certainly asked a lot of questions about it, and it appeared to the hospital at the time that that was very important to FEMA. So the hospital complied. Certainly, this was not the only FEMA case in southern Indiana at the time, but it was a major one. And it's a big issue to people. I mean, think about it, Your Honor. If you've got a heart attack in Columbus, Indiana, and you don't have a hospital to go to, you have to drive all the way to Indianapolis or down to Louisville for medical care. I mean, this hospital had to self-fund all the equipment that it purchased because it didn't get the first equipment reimbursement until 9 months later. Had it waited that long, it would be an issue of life and death for people in Columbus, Indiana.
I don't understand what the significance of almost anything you're saying is. There are credit markets. No one expects the government to write a check the day after a flood. One has to check, see what's appropriate. Credit markets are available. Hospital had access to them. And that's what they're for, borrowing against future income. So what difference does it make?
I see my time is up, Your Honor. Do you want me to continue? Or?
I would like you to answer my question. You chose to emphasize this. I would like to know what legal difference it makes.
I think it makes a difference under the statute when the purpose of the statute, the legislative history of the statute, all make it very important that Congress...
That's about as foggy as you could imagine, right? I ask you a concrete question, what difference a particular thing makes. You don't point to any language in the statute. You don't point to any language in any regulation. You don't point to anything in the legislative history. Not the legislative history counts for beans.
I would point the court to B3. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Ms. Richards.
If it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Deborah Richards, and I'm an assistant United States attorney who represents the Federal Emergency Management Agency in this case. With me at counsel's table is Kristen Shedd, who is the Deputy Associate Chief Counsel for Disaster Litigation for FEMA. Now, we're here to address two issues. Those are that there is no jurisdiction over the hospital's claims regarding equipment decisions because the Stafford Act expressly precludes judicial review of FEMA's discretionary decisions. And the second issue is that FEMA's decision was not arbitrary or capricious when...
Those are issues you raised in your brief, but you recall I began by asking Mr. Huber about the district court's subject matter jurisdiction. And that's appropriate for you, too. I was just floored that both sides' briefs in this case... Now, the hospital's brief says that jurisdiction exists under 28 U.S.C. 1331, and your brief echoes that. And I thought that one of the most well-established propositions in jurisdictional law is that 1331 does not authorize suits against the United States or the Federal Treasury. For that, you need some other statute. Now, the other statute might be 1346, the Tucker Act. There are a bunch of other statutes that expressly authorize litigation, create jurisdiction. Your brief doesn't mention the doctrine that you can't use 1331 to sue the federal government for money. I mean, what does FEMA think about jurisdiction in this case?
Your Honor, we believe that jurisdiction is not present for any discretionary function.
I'm not asking whether you think there is a review preclusion statute.
Okay.
I'm asking whether there is subject matter jurisdiction in the first place.
Your Honor, there is at best only jurisdiction under the APA, which does not...
There is no jurisdiction here under the APA. The APA's special jurisdictional clause deals with equitable relief, not money damages.
Correct.
So what do you think about the influence of the Tucker Act in this case?
The influence of the Tucker Act, the project worksheets, which would be the avenue with which money would be obligated, are not contracts. And therefore, that obligation
off.
Would not fall within the Tucker's Act.
The Tucker Act authorizes suits on contracts. It authorizes suits on statutes, such as perhaps the Stafford Act. And it authorizes suits on the Constitution. There's an express statutory claim in this case, and there's an express constitutional claim in this case.
Well, you are correct, Your Honor, that we did not brief the Tucker Act as far as jurisdictional. And certainly jurisdiction can never be waived. And if the court would like, we would be happy to
I must say, I am stunned that a lawyer representing the United States in a suit seeking millions of dollars in damages would not have paid the tiniest attention to the jurisdictional limitations in the Tucker Act. I'm stunned.
Your Honor, we interpreted the complaint to be one for relief in asking that the agency reconsider their decisions. And that would be reviewable only under the APA. To the extent that they're requesting that the court actually orders FEMA to pay monies to them in those amounts, certainly.
I don't know what the due process claim could be if it's not a claim for money damages.
Well, the due process claim, doesn't obligate the government to pay money damages. And so you must state a basis for jurisdiction under the due process, the Fifth Amendment, and we would contend that at best it is only under the APA.
So, but are you interpreting the due process claim as something where the relief would simply be more process that might or might not result in money?
Yes, Your Honor. We believe that they would have to show a property right, and then they would have to show that the process by which they
Right. Those are the steps. Suppose they showed that there was a property right and they showed that your process was flawed, then the relief would be some better kind of process.
That's
in
correct.
Which they might win or lose.
That's correct.
So it's your position, it's a step away from the money.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah. But the other parts of the case, certainly the insurance allocation and the equipment parts, are asking for money. Mm-hmm. I mean, they want money from
cash on the barrelhead.
Yeah.
They are arguing that FEMA should have obligated $1.2 million in additional equipment money.
Right.
Now, they as
and on the insurance claim, that all these claims, they all that money they got that they spent on ineligible offenses, basically they don't want FEMA to enforce its allocation rule.
That's correct.
So, again, that's money. And if you look at the language of 1346A2, it's a claim against the United States. And as Judge Easterbrook said, it's an or. Constitution, Act of Congress, regulation of an executive department, or express or implied contract.
Well, there is. We don't believe that there is a contract. These are gratuitous grants.
Right, but there is a statute.
There is a statute.
Yes. Now, from the beginning on the insurance decision, the hospitals contended that it should be able to use the insurance proceeds in any way it wanted.
There is a separate question here, which is when, if at all, an authorization, an apparent authorization in some other statute enables one to bypass the Tucker Act. That's a question that's before the Supreme Court this year in United States against Borms, where the Solicitor General is making all the sorts of arguments that you aren't, even though you are representing the same government. Have you consulted with the Solicitor General to see whether the position you're taking here is consistent with the position the government has argued before the Supreme Court in Borms?
No, Your Honor, I have not checked with the Solicitor General.
Have you read the government's brief in Borms?
No, Your Honor, I'm afraid I have not. And again, the government is happy to look at those issues and fully brief those for this court. And we regret that we did not look at those earlier. But the hospitals...
Let me ask you this. Are there other FEMA-type cases like this where money damages have been requested that have been heard in federal court versus the...
Not that I'm aware of. The The cases that have been discussed, for instance, the Hawaii case was on an APA review and it was remanded. That was on an APA review. So, and indeed in that case, the court found that for all monies received by the Hawaii, they were attributable under the deduplication statute. And there's no question that the hospital received $25 million in their insurance proceeds. Now, they want to attribute that to anything they want and argue that FEMA cannot count even a dollar toward duplication, even though the policy itself expressly covers property damage. And if you allow that type of thinking, it just sets the deduplication statute on its ear. For instance, if you were to just take their argument one step farther. Now, the hospital was underinsured for $25 million. At $25 million, they claim a $160 million loss. But let's just say the hospital had been fully insured, which presumably any entity would want to be. They would be fully insured for $160 million. Now, under their theory, they could take that $160 million, whether it covered property loss or insurance or business losses, and use that money any way they wanted, and then still come back with the $100 million that they claim they lost in FEMA-eligible expenses and ask FEMA to reimburse it for $100 million. So in essence, under what the hospital would be arguing, they would reap $260 million for a $160 million loss. They would be able to spend their $160 million insurance proceeds however they wished and still get $100 million from FEMA.
I just want to circle back to my question. So the Hawaii case dealt with the APA claim, and so all the other FEMA-related damages sort of cases have all gone to the Court of Federal Claims, to your knowledge, where there's a money request, money damages request, right?
If there is a money damage request, it would go to the Federal Court of Claims.
Okay.
And if it
and you're not aware of any other FEMA case, I mean, other than this Hawaii case where there was the dealt with the procedural issues that was not handled by that court. So I'm just trying to figure out why it didn't sort of occur to the government to do it, to see if there were other examples or, you know, just trying to get more of an understanding.
We did look at several cases, and Your Honor makes a very good point. If this is properly before the Court of Claims, there is no jurisdiction in the Seventh Circuit, mm-hmm. and the case should be sent to the Federal Court of Claims.
No, we should vacate the district court's decision and remand with instructions to dismiss for lack of jurisdiction. The case should have begun in the Court of Federal Claims. The jurisdictional problem is in the district court, not in this court.
Yes, Your Honor. I misspoke. One of the things that the hospital relies upon is this clarification of duplicative benefits rules in the Federal Register, and it talks about as if this is a FEMA document. This is actually a HUD document, and it concerns community development block grants, not the public assistance program that's at issue here. And indeed, the site that it has refers to a section that entitled Funds Not Available to the Applicant, which is clearly not the case here because the hospital did receive $25 million in insurance proceeds. The hospital also, and there was questions concerning the Herman Hospital. The hospital did not argue Herman to the district court. But even if you look at it now, what happened and what is apparent in the report is that FEMA received inadequate information concerning the insurance allocation from Herman Hospital, and it planned to adjust the apportionment of the insurance proceeds to comply with its policies after the project completion.
If there's no estoppel against the government, I don't know why you would be worrying too much about Herman either, actually. If you're right this time, you're right this time, and if you're not, you're not. But I don't know that whatever happened in Herman has much to do with it.
We fully agree with you. And that we don't think it's relevant because there was some discussion of actually what happened, but FEMA in that region, which is a different region than covers Indiana, was called to task for the way they handled the insurance benefits. And here, as you say, we have tried to apply the policy as appropriate, and we don't think Herman is at all. Is it all appropriate to consider? Now, there was some discussion as to whether there should be a discussion about the hospital's flushness with money, if you will. And indeed, it's entirely appropriate for FEMA to talk to an agency as to their money. And it was, in fact, FEMA who brought up their financial condition. And that's at the record at the supplemental appendix at 536 and the administrative record at 549.
So what would the legal significance have been if Mr. Rood had said, you know, it really galls me to have to pay you $70 million because you guys have a deep pocket, but there you go, you know, that's what the statute requires. Anything?
There's no legal significance in that because funds hadn't been obligated yet. Some type of offhand comment, if made, cannot change those things.
We have the affidavits that the comments were made. We will take that.
And indeed, what the affidavits state is that in Ms. Wilson's affidavit, she states that they were told that FEMA funding, they would not be entitled to FEMA funding for reasons other than those based upon the facts, applicable law, and rules. And that's exactly what you want a federal agency to do. To provide funding, these taxpayer grants, based upon what the rules are and what their policies are and applied to the facts. And that's exactly what happened in this case. And there's no causation, there's no linkage between this alleged bias and what actually occurred. As I said, any discussion on the financial aspects of the hospital are really geared to their wanting to keep their money so that they can maintain their bond rating, and they didn't want any monies pulled back under the duplication statute until the very end so they could keep the money available for that bond rating.
And none of the comments were made by decision makers in the chain, right?
That's correct. That's correct. Even Ms. Stacy Grantham was gone by the time any obligations of funds were made. And what is interesting to note, and as this court has already alluded to, there were hundreds of equipment decisions made, and yet only these nine are at issue. And the hospital received funds for that. It's just they wanted more money. These decisions throughout the process were made by the same people, and they were made based upon the policies and guidelines that were in effect before the disaster in 2008, and they're the same policies, they're the same guidelines that apply to all applicants under public assistance. You know, no doubt from the local perspective, the hospital believes that it could manage the nationwide FEMA program with its thousands of declared disasters each year better than what FEMA does. But FEMA managed this project very well. They set a goal of having the project worksheets 234 managed within less than a year, and they met that goal. It's just that's not really what's at issue here. Instead, the issues are whether the equipment decision was discretionary, and whether under the APA, whether the decision was arbitrary and capricious regarding the insurance proceeds. The hospital claimed that in its earlier comments that it had not asked for reimbursement for any monies that they spent the hospital funds on, but in fact they have asked in their complaint for the agency to reconsider its full deduction for the insurance. And so they are asking for all of the funds for their insurance to
go. So it's your view that this is a suit for money, basically. That's what I hear you saying.
It certainly could
with
be.
With the possible exception of the due process.
Yes, Your Honor.
Argument.
I think we've covered a lot of things. If the court has no further questions, even though I'm ahead of my time, we would ask the court for these reasons and reasons that are stated in our brief, we ask the court to affirm the district court's judgment for the defendant. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Richards. Anything further, Mr. Huber?
As to the subject matter jurisdiction question, Your Honor, the hospital is also asking for a declaratory judgment. I would point the court to 42 U.S.C. Section 2201. I do think the court has jurisdiction to consider the questions raised by the hospital in its complaint.
That's also not a jurisdictional statute.
Right.
But what I will point out is that 1631 allows for a transfer to cure want of jurisdiction. As Judge Easterbrook says, we have plenty of jurisdiction. This is an appeal from a decision of one of our district courts. But if we were to remand to the district court pointing out that it had no subject matter jurisdiction, that court might have the authority to transfer the action to any other such court in which it could have been brought at the time it was filed. And so I don't know if you're asking or want to consider that sort of relief, but that is a statute that addresses actual jurisdiction.
We're asking for the same relief that the state of Hawaii requested in the Ninth Circuit case.
If that court made a mistake about jurisdiction, right, that doesn't help us at all, though, does it?
It may not.
No, it doesn't.
The McWaters decision is another case where it appeared that everyone assumed that there was subject matter jurisdiction. I haven't read the case with your questions in mind, to be sure, but that is a case that asking for a similar relief in addition to the state of Hawaii.
Yeah, and the problem is we just can't make that assumption.
So we would ask the court not dismiss, and the court would entertain this as a request for a declaratory or injunctive relief. In response to Her Honor's questions about the affidavits, we would submit at a minimum there's a question of fact about who was making these statements.
But it has to be material. That's the problem.
And you asked opposing counsel about who made the comments. The comments were about what Stacey Gratham thought, and she was a decision maker at the time. We sought discovery about, you know, who the real decision makers were, and we don't know. And, of course, there's no evidence of that in the administrative record because there's never going to be evidence like that in the administrative record when the agency itself is in charge of preparing that record.
Well, it's hearsay insofar as Mr. Rood and Mr. Schultz told the affiant that Stacey Gratham expressed these points, insofar as she's reporting that Mr. Rood and Mr. Schultz said it to her, then she can testify about that.
I would submit it's an admission of a party opponent, and it's admissible. There certainly was no objection below to the admissibility of these statements. But here we have an admission of a party opponent.
That's the whole purpose of the... Later I was informed by Mr. Rood of FEMA that personnel at FEMA's joint field office, including Stacey Gratham, told him... I mean, really.
With my remaining time, I'd like to turn to the equipment issue. Here, we would submit that FEMA violated its own policies regarding the replacement of damaged medical equipment. And I'd cite the court to their research-related equipment and furnishings policy and their equipment policy. Both of those say that replacement of an item with a new item may be approved if a used item is not reasonably available within a reasonable cost, time, and distance. And that's the issue here. The hospital would have lost its accreditation if it acquired used equipment. FEMA was still looking for used equipment 6 months later. and the procurement standards that the statute says should be applied, 42 U.S.C. Section 5172, didn't permit the hospital to get used equipment unless it went through a very, very lengthy vetting process to make sure the equipment was safe.
I don't understand this argument at all. I mean, one would think that the value of what the hospital lost is acquisition cost less depreciation. So if you have a piece of equipment that lasts for, say, 20 years, and it's been depreciated for 19 years and is lost in the 20th year, what's been lost is the value of 1 year's use. But your argument seems to be that what's been lost is the value of 20 years' use, and FEMA should compensate that. And that's where you lose me, because that's much greater than acquisition cost less depreciation.
May I continue, Your Honor?
And always, as long as we're talking, you can answer.
I think we're talking about whether fair market value or replacement cost. In the insurance context, that's the words that would be used. Here, the regulations that FEMA itself has promulgated, it says new equipment is appropriate in a case like this where used equipment is not available within a reasonable time. We're simply asking the court to enforce.
I wish you would answer my question, however. In the case I gave you, what has the hospital lost? Has it lost more than 1 year's value of use of that piece of equipment?
I think it has. With equipment like this, it's depreciated very quickly.
Well, then it's lost less than 1 year's use. If you're engaged in accelerated depreciation, presumably you haven't lost even 1 year's use. I don't see how that helps you. Suppose you have a box of 21-use syringes.
Yes.
19 of them have been used. One remains. The box and the one remaining syringe is carried away by the flood. And the hospital will now buy a box of 20 one-use syringes, because that's what you do next. What has been lost that FEMA compensates, the value of one syringe or the value of 20 syringes?
Well, in order to be a fully functioning hospital, you have to have a whole box of syringes, not just one. That's the issue we're dealing with here. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Huber. The court invites the parties to file within 14 days supplemental memos addressing the question whether the district court had subject matter jurisdiction. You will need to discuss the effect of the Tucker Act. You will need to discuss what happens when a complaint seeks both money damages and declaratory or equitable relief. And you might see fit to discuss both the pending litigation in the Supreme Court in Borms and the Supreme Court's decision in Bowen against Massachusetts. When those briefs have been received, the case will be taken under advisement. The next case for argument this morning is